Welcome to another episode of Across the Pond, where we discuss the major stories and top investment ideas from the Eurozone and Switzerland. This week, we've seen yet more dizzying twists in President Trump's negotiations with key trading partners. The spotlight has now shifted to the European Union. On Friday, markets were briefly stunned by the threat of a 50% tariff on EU imports, which was then abruptly pushed back on Sunday. This is part of a broader pattern of aggressive threats from the Trump administration, followed by swift reversals. I'm Christopher Swan.
And I'm Belinda Peters. Today, we'll explore what the recent agreements with China and the UK might signal for the European Union's prospects. Is the so-called Trump put still in effect? And what could be next for negotiations with the European Union and Switzerland? To help us unpack what kind of deals the Eurozone might secure and what this could mean for investors, we're pleased to welcome back Dean Turner, Chief European Economist at the CIO. Dean, thank you for joining us again.
Good to be here as always, Belinda and Chris.
Yeah, so in the spirit of full transparency, we've recorded this podcast fairly late last week, and things are changing so quickly that we're being forced to re-record it. But perhaps you can just talk us through the latest developments in regard to the EU negotiations with the US.
Yeah, sure, Chris. But as you highlighted at the top, we clearly had an escalation in the trade discussions between the US and the EU last week. Although that has been rolled back, I think many are still scratching their heads with regards to the motivation for this latest escalation, and B, what is the final end game of the current trade talks. Now, in terms of motivation, it does seem that that President Trump wished to speed along the talks with the European Union. That appears to have happened, although it has to be said that, you know, it's relatively short space of time since we had the initial announcement. There hasn't been as much progress, perhaps, as many would like to hear. But clearly, with the tariffs paused at the kind of 10% baseline level until July the 9th. There is still time and scope for these negotiations to evolve. But clearly, we're not out of the woods yet when it comes to risks surrounding trade developments.
And Dean, what do you see as the main sticking points in the current negotiations with Europe? Do we have any indication of where the EU might be prepared to make concessions, so to say?
But I think the main sticking points around two areas. Let's be clear, it isn't just about tariffs on traded goods. Tariffs on traded goods between the United States and the European Union were already extremely low prior to Trump returning to the White House. What seems to be motivating a lot of the thought here is a focus on non-tariff barriers. And I think this is going to be key to unlocking negotiations, or unlocking a deal, I should say, perhaps over the medium term. Now, you know, let's be clear, there are room scope for negotiation on tariffs. Tariffs can be lowered from their already low rates in key sectors. But it's really going to be the focus on non-tariff barriers, and in particular with regard to digital taxation and other practices which the US deems to be unfair in terms of keeping its products out of the European markets. Now, where might the EU be prepared to make concessions? I think the EU have been pretty clear here. They're more than prepared to lower tariffs on traded goods and would actually favour a zero tariff trade arrangement, and have already proposed this to the EU. With regards to non-tariff barriers and with a focus on the digital taxation as well, I think this is going to be much harder to agree on. A couple of reasons for that. The first is that it will require legislation, and legislation will take time. It's not something that can be delivered on anytime soon, and that's going to be a potential sticking point. But also with regards to the digital taxation, you know, this is not only a source of income for for some European countries who impose it, but it's also seen as a mechanism to protect domestic firms against what they deem to be online competition. So, you know, I think those are the areas we've got to watch, but it's certainly not going to be an easy journey.
Can you just drill down a little further on that digital tax issue for sort of readers who are not so familiar with the discussion, and why is that such an important issue for the US?
Yeah, so look, in terms of what a digital taxation looks like, there are a number of countries across Europe, including the UK, who charge a levy on digital services providers from that are based outside of that country, and this principally affects US companies. Now, the thinking behind this is that by being, say, an online retailer or an online provider of content, that it's artificially lowering the costs and can be quite damaging to domestic firms. The digital services tax is seen as some way or some effort, perhaps, in order to kind of lessen the impact of this. It's not a case of, you know, trying to eliminate the services or competition at all. It's just as seen as a mechanism to kind of limit the impact that these service providers do have.
So it seems like maybe 1,000 years ago now that we had that deal struck between the US and China, negotiated here in Switzerland, but actually it was only a couple of weeks ago. I mean, what kind of read-through do you think that has? Obviously, sort of China had this powerful negotiating tool because they have rare earths, which are very important in a variety of industries. But do you think there is any read-through between the kind of outcome that we had with China, tentative as it was, and what the European Union might be able to negotiate?
Yeah, look, I think the read-through is really that the EU needs to focus on areas where it has leverage in this trade relationship with the United States. It seems that China had been very effective in using its leverage in order to negotiate a lower deal, and I think the European Union will probably have to go down the same route. Now, the bigger question is, does the European Union have the same kind of levers as China had, and therefore can force concessions from the US? And, you know, in my mind at this stage, I think that's a difficult argument to make. Europe is not powerless, let's be clear. Europe is a very large market. It's the largest economic bloc in the world. It is also a key supplier of goods to the United States. You know, as a bloc combined, it is the largest single source of imports for the United States. So there is some room for some leverage there and some room for negotiation, but I don't think it's going to be as clear-cut as it was for China.
I think you made a good point last time we were speaking about China's negotiating leverage, and one of it, as we said, was rare earths, and the other theme that you mentioned was the frequency aspect of Chinese imports to the US, which is that they're often goods that Americans are buying on a very frequent basis, and so it has a maybe more profound political impact. Perhaps you can just remind us of that issue.
Yes, absolutely. It's a great point. And, you know, we should bear in mind that not all trade is the same. You know, what countries are trading between each other, goods that are exported, tends to be very different. What we see a lot in a lot of China-US trade is it's the import of a lot of high-frequency purchased goods from China, so low-value goods. Therefore, if a tariff is imposed, consumers will notice the price rises pretty quickly. And again, that's going to be a key thing that the Trump administration have to watch here, because, you know, the last thing he needs is voters to get unhappy about his tariff policy. With the European Union, they tend to be less high-frequency purchased goods, much more kind of industrial goods, whether they be or pharmaceuticals and chemicals, and perhaps a little, the way to think about it is it's a little bit higher up the input chain. Therefore, any cost increase that results from tariffs is likely to be noticed by the consumer at a much slower rate. So therefore, you know, the EU's ability to use that as leverage perhaps on the US is very different to what we saw with China.
Okay, and the US-UK framework, so to say, also feels a bit like a distant memory now. But looking back, it seems that the UK did make some significant concessions. So Would this be like an indicator that countries are so eager to secure deals with the US that they are willing to compromise on, you know, substantial concessions or key standards?
Look, I think when it comes to the UK, we've got to understand that we're talking about a trade relationship that's of a very different order of magnitude to what it is than what exists with the European Union. And quite frankly, you know, for the UK as a whole, the trade exposure to the US, at least on goods trade, is a little bit less. And, you know, the UK has in the background its eyes on the bigger prize, which is essentially services trade. So let's be clear, you know, it's much easier for the UK to accept perhaps inferior terms than it had prior to the Trump administration when it comes to goods trade, because we do run a pretty sizable surplus in services trade. Other countries are not in that position. So I would be reluctant personally to use the UK as a kind of framework or an expectation for how other negotiations were going to evolve. It was a very relatively simple decision for the UK to kind of agree on this deal because of that bigger prize.
Although would a better analogy then with the UK be Switzerland? I think last time we spoke about how, what are the stakes for Swiss negotiations? Again, we're talking about significant economies, but obviously not of the scale of China or the European Union. How do you see the Swiss talks progressing?
Yeah, I think that's fair also, that in terms of the size of the overall disruption to trade, it's probably going to be something a little bit smoother in terms of negotiation. But, you know, we do have to be aware that that there are concerns here. Roughly a third of Swiss exports into the US are in the pharmaceutical sector. That suggests that you know, this is going to be a key area to watch, and that's an area where we haven't had much clarity on yet. But you know, again, you know, that this these are much smaller economies in comparison to the European Union.
And placing this in a broader market context, so to say, President Trump's, you know, unconventional negotiation style has historically prompted negative market reactions. However, now we're seeing a bit more evidence that markets are becoming less reactive to these tactics, perhaps on the expectation that he may ultimately retreat or seek compromise. As highlighted in a previous Financial Times article, which refers to the so-called taco trade, is there then a growing perception that while President Trump may trend higher tariffs, he will remain attuned to political pressures and sensitive to signals such as declining consumer confidence, which could ultimately temper his approach? What do you think about that?
Yeah, look, it's our base case that tariffs will eventually settle at around the kind of 10 to 15% effective rate, which is clearly a lot lower than has been threatened, not just in the latest EU announcements, but also in the kind of broader reciprocal tariffs that were announced on the original Liberation Day. Now, what drives that is all of the factors that you mentioned. You know, the president will have to be aware that there is an economic cost to these tariffs, then there will obviously be a political cost that will be felt as the consumer notices the impact on prices and forces lower consumptions or essentially shifting consumption decisions. Now, you know, whilst we believe that ultimately tempers his approach, we do need to be attuned to the risks in the short term. And I think those risks are really centered around the fact that we now have in office a US administration, a US president that is not just willing, but is also seems able to use the US's considerable negotiating strength when it comes to its position in the global economy.
Yeah, I guess we should probably clarify there that the Financial Times reference to the taco trade, that's Trump always chickens out.
I left that one for you, Chris.
It's a slightly pejorative way of putting it, but I guess there has been this sort of pattern of sort of making rather forceful threats and then sort of compromising on a more pragmatic approach, if we want to put that more neutrally. I mean, I guess sort of along the lines of what you were just saying, though, normally speaking, you would expect the sort of Russia-Ukraine negotiations to be obviously somewhat of a separate issue here. But is there any possibility, you think, of sort of the trade conflict or trade issues becoming entangled with maybe the different US and European priorities on ending the war between Russia and Ukraine?
I suspect it doesn't become entangled. I think both sides want to see a ceasefire or an end to the war, preferably. But I think where the trade negotiations do become entangled is clearly around questions of European security going forward. Obviously, we've had a number of announcements from large European countries, in particular Germany, acknowledging now that they've been underspending on defence for a number of years, and that is going to go into reverse. We have the NATO meeting next month, where it's likely that we will set the minimum spending of for defence at a level that's much higher than the current 2% that's in the agreement. And you know, any backsliding that that we still see here on behalf of the European Union could be used as an excuse by the US administration to raise tensions further. So that's more the channel where I think it can affect, rather than, you know, the Ukraine-Russia war itself.
And on the topic of defense spending, I have one more question. So looking at Europe from an investment perspective, there's also been a notable shift in defense spending, with some NATO members now targeting defense budgets of around 5% of GDP, up from, I think, previous 2% guideline. So what aspects of the European market do we find most attractive in this environment?
Yeah, so look, European stocks have had a good run and sort of outperformed the US in recent months. But you know, we still see that there are opportunities in Europe. I would urge investors to take a look at our investment theme, Six Ways to Invest in Europe, which we believe can still offer good potential upside for investors, especially those looking to diversify away from the United States in one of these volatile markets.
All right. Thanks, Dean. That's very actionable advice. I also want to thank our listeners. We can delve into specific securities on these podcasts, but you can explore some of these with your UBS representative. And we also very much recommend our Equity Compass, which goes into full detail about where we see the most value. But just to sum up here, we believe investors should take a selective approach in Europe, focusing on defensive companies with stable earnings and sectors set to benefit from increased defense and infrastructure spending, such as industrials, real estate, and materials, companies with limited exposure to global trade risks and strong pricing power, especially in telecommunications, financials, and healthcare, also stand out as attractive options. We'll be back soon with another installment of Across the Pond. In the meantime, have a great week.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.